from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
If you Google the words pandemic and housing, your search will yield starkly different results. There's the housing boom, referring to the real estate market surge, and the housing crisis, describing the impact of the COVID-19 economic downturn on affordable housing. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we're going to discuss the housing crisis brought on by the pandemic, and that for some preceded the pandemic. The federal government is supplying billions of dollars in aid to prevent evictions, but is that money reaching everyone who needs it? We'll talk about the current state of affordable housing in our region and post-pandemic plans to address housing insecurity. We'll also hear about a new project that's compiling oral histories about decades of housing discrimination in Louisville. And we want to hear from you. Call us this hour as we discuss housing on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the effects of the coronavirus pandemic on affordable housing here in Louisville, across our region, and beyond. And we want to bring you into that conversation. You can call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle. We're on Facebook. What's been your experience during the pandemic with housing? Have you faced eviction? Are you seeking help with paying your rent or your house payment? Give us a call and let us know how you're doing and what your thoughts on that. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. That's a little later in the program, but first we want to tell you about a new project related to housing that's underway here in Louisville. Louisville's Metropolitan Housing Coalition and the University of Louisville are collaborating on an oral history project regarding housing discrimination in Louisville over the generations. And joining us to talk about it and many other things are Tony Curtis, Director of Development and Communications for the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. Tony, welcome to the program.
And thanks for having me, Rick.
Michael L. Jones is with us. He is an award-winning journalist and author from here in Louisville, and he's going to be conducting the oral history interviews. You've seen Michael's work in Leo, Insider, Louisville, Louisville Magazine, many other publications, and he's been involved in many other projects as well. Michael, good to have you back with us.
I'm glad to be back with you.
Tony, first of all, excuse me, for those who don't know, could you just give us an overview of what the Metropolitan Housing Coalition is and what it does?
Yes, we are an advocacy and education organization in Louisville that fights for fair and affordable housing across all of Louisville, giving access to people in all of our community. We are really known for our publication of the State of Metropolitan Housing Report. We've been doing that since 2003, which really focuses on a kind of holistic view of housing in Louisville. We focus on a focus topic and then nine measures, and we've done that since 2003. So we're continually out in the community doing research-based, evidence-based advocacy, trying to build a better and more inclusive Louisville for people.
So let's talk about the Oral History Project. Tell us about that and why the decision was made to launch it now.
Okay, yeah, most definitely. Well, my former colleague Kathy Hinko and I were out in the community having community conversations, as we often do, especially pre-pandemic in person. And we kept hearing feedback from people. We were talking about the last State of Metropolitan Housing Report. We were talking about the inability of especially Black folks to build wealth over decades and decades and how that's impacted housing. And we kept getting feedback from individuals at these events talking about how their families, their parents themselves were denied access to housing, denied access to loans, also denied access to educational opportunities. Even some World War II vets who were coming back home did not have access to the funds to be able to continue education or be accepted into these educational institutions. So we came up with the plan and the idea that we really need to document these histories, and what better way to do that than through an oral history project where you have individuals telling their story, their family's stories, in their own words. And this will be housed in an archive, and that's what we want to do, is build the archive of voices that have been intentionally left out over the decades of museums, of archival institutions. So we came up with a plan, and we are now executing that with the help of Michael Jones.
Well, let me turn to Michael Jones. Michael, you're going to be doing these interviews. Who do you hope to talk to, and have you begun doing the interviews?
Yes, I've been doing the interviews for a couple of months. COVID's kind of slowed it down. A lot of the older people don't like using Zoom.
Yeah.
So, but I got vaccinated, so I've been going and doing a couple in-person interviews. I talked to Maddie Jones, the civil rights activist, last week, and the few other people I've talked to have been one really interesting was Reginald Meek's sister, Renelda Walker. She lives in New York now, and she talked about growing up in the Parkland neighborhood and how it changed overnight after the riots in 68. And she was a wealth of information because she was also involved in the open housing protest and things like that. So one of the main things that's coming out in the people I've talked to so far is the connection between education and your zip code, you know, once busing started.
I'm always reminded, because race and housing in Louisville go way back, you know, for generations. I'm always reminded, I did a story on it for the anniversary, back in 1954 when Ann and Carl Braden bought a house for a black family that wanted to move into the Shively area. Then, back then, a new development in Shively. And they bought the house for them because they couldn't get it themselves. And, of course, they were met with the house was firebombed. There were crosses burned in their yard. But that's just a tremendous story. And I'm sure, Michael, you're going to be hearing a lot more stories like that occurred over the generations here in Louisville.
Oh, sure. You know, I'm hoping to be able to talk to one of the Wades, which were the family involved in that. And I think Shively itself is very interesting because it's now becoming largely an African-American community. So, like, there's been a lot of influx of African-American homebuyers there. So that's one thing I'm wanting to explore.
We're talking with Michael L. Jones and Tony Curtis about an oral history project they're working on in conjunction involving the Metropolitan Housing Coalition and the University of Louisville about housing discrimination in Louisville over the years. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be broadening our conversation to talk about affordable housing in Louisville and across the country, and really around the world, that's been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. And we welcome your calls, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-6565. You can send us a tweet if you'd like. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this. And if you're going through a situation, WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Have you found, Tony, with this project that discrimination impacts and impacted black people when they rent and not just when they tried to buy a house?
Yes, that's and we talk about that a lot in our State of Metropolitan Housing reports, and the data shows that pretty consistently. We've kind of made an intentional decision in this project, at least in the first 21 interviews, that we have grant funding from the Kentucky Oral History Commission from, is the focus on homeowners and discrimination. So it definitely exists. There is a desperate impact on black households in Louisville because if you look at homeownership numbers in Louisville, white households own at a rate of 71%. Black households own at a rate of 36-37%. So you can see the numbers there show a large portion of African Americans, black households that are renters in Louisville as compared to white households. So the discrimination exists there. And one of the, I think, the aims of this project is to point out that, hey, this is not something that just happened in the past. It's happened through multiple generations. It happens today. And unless we confront it, understand it, and hear the stories of those who have experienced it, it's going to continue to happen in the future. So we need to make that stop.
Well, let's talk about that, because unfortunately this is not a past tense thing. Perhaps it was more blatant and overt back generations ago, but talk about ways that housing discrimination manifests itself these days.
Okay, yeah. One good example is there was a recent ordinance that was passed by Metro Council, an expansion of the Fair Housing Ordinance in protected classes. And one of those protected classes is now you are not allowed to discriminate against people because of source of income. That was a huge victory in the fight for fair housing in Louisville, because you often see this. You'll drive around, you'll see a for rent sign, and it says no Section 8 accepted. So with that, we know a large percentage, the majority of the percentage of vouchers that go out to individuals in Louisville are African-American and Black households. So if you're seeing landlords who are discriminating against potential tenants based on the source of income of having Section 8 vouchers or any vouchers, then that is discrimination in our current state. So that's just one example of many instances where it continues on in today's society.
Michael, talk about what kind of response have you gotten from the people that have you talked to, or that you're reaching out to gather these histories? Are they enthusiastic about talking about it?
Yes. And I would say what Tony said about Section 8 has come up, because that's something that people who are were living in Beach Terrace, but they're being relocated, a lot of them are being given Section 8 vouchers, and they're still being limited to where they can live in certain neighborhoods because some places won't accept them. But this is, housing involves, like, connects with so much of a person's life, you know, that people, there's like so many facets of it, and people are usually very anxious to talk about it. When my grandfather found out that I was working on this project, he told me, like, I grew up in the California neighborhood, and he told me the only reason he was able to buy the house I grew up in was because a white friend of his bought the house and sold it to him.
Wow.
And this is on Hill Street. So I lived very close to Shively.
Just a few seconds before we need to take a break, but give us a sense of the timeline on this, Michael. When do you expect these to be completed, and when we can read about them and hear them?
Well, I think that we have until September for this first phase, but we're trying to get additional funding because we got funded for 21 interviews, and the response we're getting and the need, I think, is greater than that. And we have a great committee set up with people like Sadiqua Reynolds and Judge Denise Clayton. And so they're helping us kind of frame this project and look for more funding sources.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back. We're going to be joined by Louisville Metro Councilwoman Cassie Chambers-Armstrong as we discuss housing on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. And for the rest of the program, we're going to talk about affordable housing, how the pandemic has affected people's ability to stay in their homes and to find affordable housing. Affordable housing, of course, was an issue in most cities and communities pre-pandemic, and certainly it's not going away post-pandemic, but this seems like an opportunity to look at the problem with the benefit of hindsight as well. And our guest for the rest of the program, Tony Curtis, Director of Development and Communications for the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. Michael L. Jones will be with us for this second segment. He's an award-winning journalist and author and taking part in this oral history that's being collected by the Coalition and the University of Louisville about housing discrimination in Louisville. And welcome to the program, Cassie Chambers Armstrong, Metro Council Representative for District 8 in Louisville. Councilwoman Armstrong, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
And again, we want to hear your experiences with affordable housing and how the pandemic has affected you. Maybe you faced eviction or are facing eviction or worried about how you're going to pay the rent or pay the mortgage and stay afloat here during these pandemic months that are not quite over yet, but we're starting to see light at the end of the tunnel. We want to hear your experiences. Give us a call, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you'd rather do that. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Let's start, Tony, just define affordable housing. What does that mean in terms of the work you do with the coalition?
So we work on developing units, and these units are for individuals. We focus on 80% of area median income and below. So we're looking for the development of housing for individuals who fall within that range with the ability to rent those houses. That's the need is great. There is a need of 31,412 units needed for 30% of AMI and below alone. And it comes out to about 58,000 for 80% of area median income. So it's a question of housing stock. It's a question of incorporating affordable housing units within new developments when they're built. We need to write that into policy. We need to come up with a formula for that to happen. And so we're out there every day pushing our coalition of about 300 members, which are financial institutions and nonprofit developers, to create more accessibility and give people the opportunity to own housing and rent housing throughout the entire community.
And we've been reporting on affordable housing here for years, pre-pandemic. How has the outbreak of the coronavirus affected the availability of affordable housing and keeping people in their homes during this time?
There's been a housing crisis in Louisville for a long time. This is not something that has just happened. The pandemic has definitely magnified the issues associated with affordable housing. Evictions have definitely been an issue that have there was an eviction crisis before COVID-19 hit, and it's only intensified and magnified those issues related to that, whether it be eviction court issues, whether it be people spending all of their savings, if they had savings at the beginning of the pandemic, to be able to afford to stay in their house, pay their rent, pay their utilities, and thankfully there have been rental assistance programs that have been in place at the local state level and through a lot of federal funding in order to kind of curtail some of this. And we've seen an impact in the community on those to allow people to actually stay in their homes. Is it perfect? No. Do we need more funding? Yes. It's definitely a crisis. It's definitely been exacerbated. And we definitely need to really focus on a policy that is not only short term with some of these programs, but we need to really look at the long term of how to integrate these possibly some of these successes into how we deal with affordable housing in Louisville.
Now, President Biden has extended the federal moratorium on evictions, Tony, I believe, until the end of June. What exactly does that mean? Does that apply across the board to everyone, or are there exceptions to that?
They do. I can't speak at the moment to the. I haven't seen his extension to exactly if anything has changed to the previous moratorium. Governor Beshear, I believe, has also, as of yesterday or the day before, extended the basically mirrored the CDC moratorium in Kentucky through the end of June. So there is definitely a requirement that these are for non-payment of rent. But we do see landlords who are looking at other issues in order to evict. whether that be through, some kind of damage that has been done to the property or other violations of the lease. So there's definitely loopholes. Those need to be closed. And we would hope that both the at the state level and the federal level that these would be addressed because you can't be healthy at home if you don't have a home.
Right. And evictions involve the court system. And Councilwoman Cassie Chambers Armstrong, let me turn to you because you've been involved in trying to help some folks that find themselves in the court system with evictions. Tell us about the right to to counsel measure that you've been proposing to the Metro Council.
Sure. So first, I want to just pick up on something Tony was saying and just really drive it home because I think it's an important point, and that's that we've had almost 1,200, 1,300 people in the city of Louisville be evicted while this supposed moratorium is in place. And so that's why I don't like calling it a moratorium. I like talking about the CDC protections as opposed to the moratorium, because there are all of these reasons that people can find to get around to still be able to file an eviction to get someone out of their home and basically cause someone to lose their housing, which is a big deal in the best of times, the sort of taking someone out of housing, putting them at risk of becoming unhoused, and certainly in the middle of a pandemic when there are so many other considerations in place that we don't normally have as part of that background. And so this is something commonly right now we see people being evicted for overstaying their lease, sort of the lease term has run. It's now been a year since these protections have been in place. A landlord won't renew that lease term, which then puts the home renter at risk of having an eviction filed against them. And we know that Kentucky state law has so few protections for home renters. You only have to give someone 3 days notice between sort of filing an eviction action and actually having that eviction heard in court. You can enter a judgment of eviction against someone in that first court hearing, unlike almost any other court proceeding. And you don't have to give that home renter actual notice of the eviction action that's been filed against them. You don't have to actually prove that home renter knows that they're facing an eviction. You just have to prove that you took a piece of paper that said that they had to be in court and put it somewhere on the premises of a property. And so when we're talking about a multi-unit apartment building, we're talking about a multi-unit place, that means a lot of times the person who's facing eviction doesn't even know that they're supposed to show up in court. And so all of these things, the sort of the fact that the law in Kentucky is so unfriendly, the fact that we don't have a lot of protections, that's exactly why I decided to file this right to counsel ordinance, which basically looks at the lowest income individuals, those who are extremely low income and have children under the age of 18 in the home, and tries to provide some type of due process protection, someone to be their advocate through this eviction process by giving them an attorney who's really uniquely situated to help them deal with the eviction process and make sure that they can get a favorable outcome on the other side.
Well, the eviction process and the court system, that's complicated for people who even have a passing knowledge of how the court system works, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. I started my background as a legal aid attorney. I saw firsthand how having an attorney is a game changer. It changes the process. It changes the outcome. It changes the way that you think about going through the proceeding and how empowered you feel to sort of negotiate and take charge of reaching a good outcome for you. And so in the eviction process, a lot of people think, oh, providing people with an attorney, that sounds really abstract. Is that what we should be spending our money on right now? Shouldn't we be putting it into rental assistance? And the answer is yes, we should absolutely be putting it into rental assistance. But a right to an attorney is not this abstract thing. An attorney can help negotiate a move-out agreement, which I sort of tell people is a little like the civil law equivalent of a plea deal. It sort of lets people move out on their own terms. They can negotiate to maybe get their security deposit back. They can find new housing before they have to move out of their old housing. They can make sure that eviction judgment doesn't actually get entered on their record, which we know you can't ever get rid of that. So once you have that eviction judgment, you can't expunge it. It stays with you forever, and it follows you wherever you go and can cause you to not qualify for benefits in the future and not be able to get safe, healthy, affordable housing in the future. An attorney can even just answer questions like, do I have to show up to this hearing? Where do I go for my court date? How do I get into the Zoom motion hour? There are so many things that people don't understand. It's a confusing process, sometimes even for lawyers who don't specialize in housing law. And so asking these people who are going through a lot of other stuff in their life to take the time out to become an expert in housing law is just unfair. And there's no reason that we shouldn't be sort of making the process fair, making sure that people have an opportunity to have a good outcome.
And where does your proposal stand on offering help, excuse me, to the folks who need it?
So we introduced the proposal, I guess it's been 2 weeks ago now, and we've received a really overwhelming outpouring of support from a whole host of organizations, from people in the community. This was not an ordinance that I just sort of pulled out of my back pocket. We spent a lot of time talking to different organizations in the community. Both my legislative assistant and I have a background in civil legal aid services. We talked to impacted groups. And this is something that a lot of our peer cities have been doing for a long time. So, for example, the city of Cleveland is implemented something that is as close to our ordinance as any other city. It's sort of similar guidelines, similar categories of folks. And they saw that it was 93% effective at keeping people housed, which is an incredible number. And it's not that people get to stay in that same unit that someone's trying to evict them from for forever. But what we saw was that people were able to stay housed. They were able to stay in sort of safe, affordable housing. It reduced homelessness in children. We know that having a judgment of eviction entered against you is the single biggest predictor for families with kids becoming homeless. And so if we're going to start somewhere, sort of starting with this idea of let's make sure that the children in our community don't experience homelessness. Let's do whatever it takes to keep those families with kids in the home in housing. And so I think that basic common sense idea, cities that have done this, it's been so effective, both in terms of the outcomes and also the cost-effective outcomes. Cleveland, or actually I think it was Philadelphia, that saw savings of $7 for every dollar they spent. And a lot of that was just in direct shelter cost reduction. The fact that they just weren't paying to provide shelter to people who had become unhoused through this process, which is an incredible number. And so the data is there. Peer cities have done it. They've done it effectively. It's common sense. It's a way to provide fairness. And so we've seen a lot of support for the proposal.
Let me reintroduce everyone. You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL in Kentucky Public Radio. We are talking with Louisville Metro Councilwoman Cassie Chambers Armstrong, whose voice you just heard. Also with us on the program are Tony Curtis, Director of Development and Communications for the Metropolitan Housing Coalition, Michael Jones, local journalist and interviewer for an oral history that he and Tony with the, and the coalition are working on the history of housing discrimination in Louisville. And we're talking about affordable housing amid the pandemic here in the Louisville area and beyond, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, with our guest. And we welcome your input. Call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet, WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Let me come back to you, Michael, because you're collecting these oral histories, and this is really an opportunity at this time of crisis and pandemic to talk about how that is affecting the most vulnerable people in terms of housing during the pandemic. As you're collecting these histories, people disproportionately affected by coronavirus are also disproportionately affected by this housing crisis, right?
Yes. And not only that, but environmental issues are something else that's coming up in connection with housing. Just because of redlining, you know, most of the places African Americans live were industrial designations.
Let's talk about just the availability of affordable housing in general. And Councilwoman Armstrong, I want to come back to you. What types of discussions is the council having about working toward increasing the supply of affordable housing in Louisville?
Well, we're having a lot of conversations because the crisis of affordable housing is one that we have to come at with a lot of tools from a lot of different angles. So one, like I just talked about, is providing procedural protections for those facing eviction, providing support to people facing eviction, making sure that people who are housed currently do not become unhoused. Because we know, one, it's just the thing that government should do, the right thing to do, is to make sure every member of our community has housing. But we also know that once someone becomes unhoused, the costs associated with getting them back into housing are just so much greater than making sure that they stay in their home in the first place. So we got to tackle it from that perspective. We have to be thinking about our neighbors who are unhoused currently. We have had a real crisis and a real, I think something like an 800% increase in the number of people in our community who are experiencing homelessness over the past decade. And so we got to make sure that we are thinking about immediate solutions for those folks as well. Long term, and this is where, you know, I'm someone that I want something to happen tomorrow. I want to snap my fingers and fix the problem. But we do have to think long term about how we increase our affordable housing stock in the city. Because like Tony was saying, we have this shortage of 31,000 units. Think about how many people, how many units of housing that is. We are short that number of units in our city that there are people, extremely low income people, who need that housing, and it doesn't exist. And that's contributing to all of these other problems we see about households that rent being cost burdened and being at high risk of eviction and subsequently being at high risk of becoming homeless. And so the Affordable Housing Trust Fund is one of the best tools that we have to increase our affordable housing supply in the long run. I am hopeful. We're still waiting on guidance about what the American Rescue Plan stimulus dollars can be spent on. But we know that the city of Louisville is getting an unprecedented influx of cash from that plan, $454 million. That's close to $500 million. And if we can put some of that money into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund and into other long-term initiatives to really make sure that we're making a dent in this affordable housing crisis, I think that that could be something that can move the needle on a lot of other issues that our city faces. I believe in a housing-first model. I believe that if we fix our crisis around affordable housing, we will fix a lot of other problems in the city.
Let me stay with you, Councilwoman Armstrong. In terms of that money, is there a timeline at this point? Is it too early to say when all these funds are going to flow in and when decisions are going to be made about how they're allocated?
We're still waiting on a specific timeline and some more guidance and additional sort of regulations around it. I've spoken with folks at the city, and I know that they are as eager as I am to sort of get these answers. And so the moment that we have clear guidance on what we can and can't do, I expect that we'll start having public-facing conversations about, you know, what are we going to do with this money? How are we going to use this to really help our city recover? Of course, there will always be restrictions in place, but we know that a lot of it sort of the driving purpose is to help our city recover from the pandemic. And one of the things that we have seen is this crisis in helping people stay housed and in finding affordable housing. And so I would argue that this is an opportunity to address one of the most direct impacts of the pandemic, as well as an underlying longstanding issue in our community, and make sure that we are really providing a long-term sustainable solution for affordable housing.
We need to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to take your calls. We have a couple of people on hold. We need to say goodbye to Michael L. Jones, who is going to be the interviewer for the oral histories that are being collected on housing discrimination. Michael, thanks for joining us. Best of luck with that, and we'll keep up to date on what's going on with that.
Okay, thank you. I can't wait to share it with you.
Tony and Councilwoman Armstrong will stay with us. We're going to be joined by Graham Ambrose from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, who's going to talk about the eviction relief funds and how those funds are not getting to certain people in the state. We're going to talk about that and much more. Take your calls when we come back on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this hour we're talking about affordable housing, and the affordable housing crisis has been exacerbated by the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic. Of course, there's been an affordable housing issue in Louisville and elsewhere pre-pandemic, and there's discussions about what to do post-pandemic. Our guest this hour are Louisville Metro Councilwoman Cassie Chambers Armstrong, who represents District 8 here in Louisville. Tony Curtis is Director of Development and Communications for the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Graham Ambrose from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, who's been looking into how eviction relief funds are being allocated and the difficulty that some people have had getting those funds. And we're going to start kick off here with a piece Graham did a couple of weeks ago on that very topic, as residents struggling to pay their rent can now access thousands of dollars in cash from the government, but that money isn't getting to hundreds of renters here in Kentucky due to a loophole. Landlords who simply refuse to cooperate. And I think we have a couple of callers that we'll talk to who want to talk about just that. Well, the government could pay those renters directly, but as Graham Ambrose of the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting found, government agencies are choosing not to.
It's mid-February, and Governor Andy Beshear is at the podium for his regular press briefing about COVID-19.
This piece of good news is important, and it's going to help a lot of people who have struggled through this pandemic.
Today, he's feeling excited. Congress is giving Kentucky almost $300 million to help people who are struggling to pay their rent or utilities. The program requires landlords to agree not to evict a renter for a certain amount of time, 75 days. Payments are generous, up to 12 months of past rent and up to 3 months of future rent. But there's a catch.
Payments will be made directly to landlords or to utility providers.
And if renters want the relief money, their landlord has to agree to apply for the funds. So what happens if a landlord doesn't want to apply for the money? It might sound counterintuitive, but across Kentucky, landlords are passing up the assistance. In Louisville alone, at least 350 renters haven't gotten money because their landlords didn't want to accept it.
It's a huge issue.
That's Christina Libby, a housing advocate at the Homeless and Housing Coalition of Kentucky. She sat in on eviction court throughout the fall, helping people fill out paperwork to keep the roof over their heads. One of the forms asks,
"Have you applied for all available assistance?" And they would always say yes. And most of the time, they would say, "But my landlord won't take it."
Advocates say the issue isn't good tenants versus bad landlords. The problem is a confusing and hard-to-access policy that fails to meet the needs of all Kentuckians. Carrie Barron, a housing advocate with the Catholic Action Center, a shelter in Lexington, says it's a trust issue between some landlords and the government.
You know, these landlords need to know that they can trust where, you know, that the money is going to come, that the city will follow through.
Barron says one of the biggest problems is misinformation for both landlords and tenants.
Landlords are frustrated. You know, there used to be the state program open, and now it's closed, and then it was open, and then it was closed again. And now, you know, it goes to the city. There's so much to keep track of, and they're not getting enough information.
COVID-era eviction relief programs are new, and they're hardly straightforward. Federal rules do allow tenants to receive the money directly. No need for landlord cooperation. But the administrators of Kentucky's three funds say the rules are too cumbersome to give out the money directly. That's a problem for renters like Jayla Fisher, who was laid off last spring as the pandemic was beginning to upend the economy.
So I went to, you know, donate plasma to even try to get a little bit of money.
By November, the 26-year-old owed almost $3,000 in rent to Southwood Apartments, where she lived. So she applied to the relief fund in Louisville. But she says her landlord wouldn't cooperate, and she couldn't get the money. A lawyer for her Southwood Apartments declined to comment for the story. Feeling defeated, Fisher decided to abandon the apartment to preempt an eviction.
I just didn't want the eviction on my record.
The landlord loophole is galling to housing advocates like Libby, who thinks the funding is a win-win for renters and their landlords.
If you evict someone, the likelihood of you getting what they owe you is very, very low. And 90% of what you're owed is much more than not only nothing, but then also, you know, ruining somebody else's credit down the road.
Advocates say these evictions endanger renters and their families amid a public health emergency. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Graham Ambrose.
And you're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio as we're talking about affordable housing and evictions and the pandemic this hour on the program. Our guests are Cassie Chambers Armstrong, Louisville Metro Councilwoman for District 8, Tony Curtis, Director of Development and Communications at the Metropolitan Housing Coalition here in Louisville, and Graham Ambrose, who you just heard from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Graham, are you with us?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Good to have you, Graham. Well, let's talk about the story that we just heard. I think you filed it a couple of weeks ago. What, if anything, has happened since then? I know you had a chance to ask Governor Beshear about some of the issues that were brought up in your piece.
Exactly. So we asked Governor Beshear, you know, what is the state going to do about this loophole in which landlords can, you know, deny their tenants' funding that I think a lot of policymakers assume that they would simply want. I know the phrase that you keep hearing when you talk to housing advocates is free money. This is pretty much as close to free money as it gets in today's age. It's up to, you know, 12 months of past rent due, 3 months of future rent. And in some cases, landlords are walking away from this with $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 checks to cover rent that was owed them that was never paid because of the pandemic, how it upended the economy. So when landlords are refusing to accept this money, it's sort of a confusing situation, and there's all sorts of reasons why landlords, particularly here in Louisville but elsewhere in Kentucky as well, are denying it. And the governor, you know, we asked him, you know, what are you going to do about this? And since we've reported this, the state fund is willing to pay renters directly as a kind of last resort if there's multiple documented attempts to secure their landlord participation. Their landlord simply won't.
Let's go to the phones. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. Let's go to Brittany in Louisville, who I believe has been in this very situation. Hello, Brittany. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind? Tell us. Tell us what about your situation.
Yeah, so as a citizen alongside Felix Crittenden, I have gotten to multiple eviction court dates, and I have witnessed many landlords refuse to accept the money, and the judges would throw their hands up and say, well, I can't make them accept the money. So I know that Tony Curtis just mentioned that source of income has just been added as a protected class, but in what way is that going to be offered to the citizens in order to maintain housing?
Tony, will you want to respond to that?
Yes, I think it's uncertain at this point, and I'm not a lawyer by training, about how that discrimination on source of income would apply to landlords who are not accepting the rental assistance programs. So a lawyer would have to look into that for sure, but because I don't know if that's considered income or what how that's defined. So that's definitely an issue. As she was saying, there are landlords who are refusing to provide their W-9s in order to receive the rental assistance. And I don't know what the issue is there. It makes me ask some strange questions in my mind as to why they don't want to provide that W-9 in order to get their back rent or future rent. So that's a question that really needs to be answered in our community. And just the very question about all of the barriers that are put up about documentation that needs to be provided as a part of the first round of funding. The second round of funding was a little bit more repressive as far as the amount of documentation. And let's hope this third round of funding, there's a loosening up of that to make sure people get the funding they need and to keep people in their homes and to keep children in their homes. And that's a whole other discussion we get into about the number of students in JCPS who are facing housing issues.
Councilwoman Armstrong, I want to let you get in on this, too. Is this something people have approached you about?
It's something that I've heard about. It's something that we discussed at, I believe it was a budget committee hearing several weeks ago. And, you know, just in general, I think it's important that we sort of step back and remember the situation that a lot of low-income folks are in when they're trying to access, be it, you know, a rental assistance program, a utility assistance program, whatever type of assistance it is, oftentimes, and I've sort of gone and tried to look at some of these forms myself and put myself in the shoes of someone going through it, a lot of times it's confusing. There are different organizations that are sort of have different pockets of money, different buckets of money. The money will run out somewhere and you'll get sent somewhere else and they'll run out before you get there. You'll have to fill out pages and pages of documentation that's not really clear. You might not have that documentation readily available. And so we put a really big burden on folks that have a lot of other stuff going on in their lives. I mean, just like the rest of us, these are people that, you know, don't have reliable childcare, have maybe been trying to do school at home with their kids. And now we're sort of placing all of these other logistical barriers on the ways that they can access the assistance that we're providing. And so, you know, I think whenever we look at this sort of uptake and we see uptake levels that are lower from sort of the renter side or the person who really needs the direct assistance, if there's low uptake, we have to ask ourselves why. And a lot of times it's because we aren't doing a good job of making those programs user-friendly and coordinating all the services and getting the information out in a way that's understandable that people can actually utilize. As for the landlord issue, it's something the city has limited legal ability to do anything about that. But it's obviously concerning. And it's one of those loopholes that sort of, you know, I'm glad that Governor Beshear is going to close it and offer this sort of last resort. I hope that it's not too onerous on folks to get to that last resort and be able to get that direct assistance themselves. Because again, when we make things too burdensome, we really just undermine what we're trying to do in the entire system.
I want to thank Brittany for her call. Graham Ambrose, is that something that you've encountered in your reporting? We're throwing a lot of money at people in the name of relief for different things, but there seems to be a lot of confusion about how the process works. Is that something you've encountered in talking to people about this?
Absolutely. And I think, as Councilwoman Armstrong was saying, when laws are old and there's a lot of practice around them and they're generally well understood, the law itself might be confusing, but because there's so much practice and general communal understanding about how these laws work, it's not usually a problem. But when programs are brand new, there often is, a lot of good faith disagreement about what they actually mean, or about, how some of these loopholes work, how what the letter of the law really says and how it should be interpreted. And these good faith disagreements about what the law says and how the program should be run can often lead to just devastating outcomes. From no one's poor fault, people can fall through the cracks. And so, yes, I've been, talking to tenants all over Louisville, Lexington, and here in Kentucky. One of the questions I think that was asked was, why would landlords pass this up? Why wouldn't they just want to take the money? And certainly some of the reasons that have already been said are true. I mean, they don't want to file a W-9 in some cases. Some are just philosophically opposed to taking government money. They don't want any more government scrutiny over their portfolios. And some landlords just have a terrible relationship with their tenant. I mean, they might say, hey, yeah, I will take a loss on this, but I just want them out. I mean, I do not want to continue this relationship any longer. And if I have to lose a certain amount of money for that, so be it.
Well, I guess there are bad tenants. And Steve, who called but couldn't stay, says, would be helpful if local government could help pay for damaged tenants' dues. That Section 8 used to do that, but doesn't anymore. Let's get another landlord perspective from Jane, who was in Richmond, Kentucky. Jane, welcome to In Conversation.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. What's on your mind?
My parents, my dad was a builder. He built a couple of apartment buildings. My mom helped run them. They both passed away. I inherited them. And I try to keep it. They're nice. They're well-built apartments. They kept them in good shape. I've tried to keep the, but they're older, so I keep the rent low and keep them in excellent shape. But I had some people who get government checks. They never, two in particular tenants, and they paid the rent with their checks. They paid the rent religiously until the day that it was said that no one could be evicted. It was the last day that I got any rent from them. By the time one of them quit, then the rest of the tenants don't want to pay, because why are they paying when everybody else isn't? They began to harass me. I was staying in one of the apartments to kind of patrol it. I had eggs thrown at me. I had taunts. When they got their $1,200 check, bragged about spending it all on women and drugs, and the other ones partied continuously. I try, if I had one person who truly lost a job, many of them quit jobs when they knew they didn't have to pay rent. I have a few apartments. I try to keep them so I don't put people on the street. Anyway, I'm scared to death to rent them. They sit empty now. I'm angry. My dad never used government help. So now I'm hearing that they left because they got too violent and the police were having to be called. So
okay.
It's not.
Well, thanks for your call. Appreciate your perspective, Jane. Thanks for calling. You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. We're talking about affordable housing and eviction relief, as we've been discussing. Let me go back to the affordable housing stock, Tony. I wanted to ask you something I read when I was doing a little bit of research for the program. Is the concept of rehabilitating vacant properties. Now, we've had a glut of vacant properties here in Louisville. Now, that takes money, of course. I know New York had a big program where they did that and spent over $1 billion. But is that something that you've advocated for here in Louisville, is taking a look at assessing their vacant properties and figuring out which ones could be rehabilitated and maybe adding that to the affordable housing stock?
I think that's definitely part of the equation. I don't think there's one solution to the affordable housing crisis in Louisville. I think there are many approaches, and definitely a piece of that puzzle is renovating properties that are vacant, or they're able to be renovated, building on properties that have no current building on them, but making those accessible to the people in the neighborhoods who live in that neighborhood in order to encourage, you know, the building of wealth over long periods of time, and building of community and building of neighborhoods. There are people who want to own homes, and they just, like you said, can't afford that. There is a stock of vacant properties, some owned by the city, and some that that just need to be made accessible. So I think the question is who do we make those available to? Two, do we make them available to the people in the neighborhoods? Do we make them available to nonprofit developers? How do we increase and use that as a piece of the puzzle to find a solution to affordable housing in Louisville?
And before I run out of time, Tony, I want to get some information about the Oral History Project. Where can people find information about that, and maybe who might be interested in participating?
Okay, they can visit the metropolitanhousing.org. They can also find us on social media at MHC Louisville. Again, that's at MHC Louisville. There's actually a big event coming up. April is Fair Housing Month. And on April 27th, we will be doing a oral history kind of event called Unfair Housing in Louisville, a community listening session. So we are encouraging community members to share their personal and family experiences to barriers to housing in Louisville. We want to get that intergenerational perspective. It will all be conducted on Zoom due to the ongoing pandemic, but we invite them to do that, and they can find out more information on our social media about that event.
And that, you said that's April 27th?
April 27th at 5:30 p.m., and you can register through our social media.
Very good. I want to thank all of our guests, Tony Curtis from the Metropolitan Housing Coalition, Louisville Metro Councilwoman Cassie Chambers Armstrong, and Graham Ambrose from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Great work as always, Graham. Thank you all for joining us, and we will stay on top of this as the pandemic goes on and hopefully comes to an end soon. Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells. Special thanks today to Sally Evans. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.